Hello, everyone, and welcome to Recent Advances in Cancer Care, New Paradigms, Novel Agents, and What It Means for the Oncology Nurse, Strategies to Safety and Effectively Implement Antibody-Drug Conjugates. I'm Dr. Kathleen Moore, and I'll be moderating the meeting today. This is our faculty for today. I'm going to briefly introduce them, and they can wave and say hello. From the James Cancer Hospital at The Ohio State University, Courtney Arne. From Mayo Clinic, Jamie Carroll. From the David Geffen School of Medicine, Dr. Eddie Guerin. And from the UT Southwestern Medical Center, Dr. Heather MacArthur. These are just our disclosures. I'm going to flip through these relatively quickly so you can see. And these are all available for you in the meeting materials. Here's the commercial support for today. Research to Practice CME Planning Committee staff and reviewers have no COI to disclose. This program will contain disclosures of non-approved uses of agents and regimens, so please refer to official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. The education themes of all 11 programs focus on the integration of new agents, regimens, and therapies into oncology practice, when they should be used, for whom, and why, as well as how to prevent and manage associated side effects. So this is just what we're going to be doing today. And this is where we're headed today. We'll start out with an overview of antibody-drug conjugates, then we'll discuss HER2-targeted antibody-drug conjugates in breast cancer, followed by a review of available antibody-drug conjugates in gynecologic cancers, then lung cancer. Then we'll focus on TROP2 in breast cancer and spend the last portion of the program talking about promising new antibody-drug conjugates in gynecologic and lung cancers. So with that, let's get started. We have a lot to cover. And so I'm just going to open up the discussion to my panel right now. I'll put up this slide. Little cartoon that we've all seen. How do you explain to a patient sitting in your clinic in front of you about a new medication that you're going to start that's an antibody-drug conjugate? How does it differentiate from other therapies they might have received? Why don't I start with Dr. Guerin?
Yeah, so when I describe antibody-drug conjugates, I explain that the component that is active in this is really still a chemotherapy. And the idea is to deliver the chemotherapy more specifically to the target so you can get higher doses of drug, hopefully with less side effects. And that these targets are in many cases chosen based on the disease, that this is a disease that is known to express a lot of this target. And in a few cases, is based on a specific abnormality in that person's tumor. So where, for instance, that their tumor among that disease, among lung cancer, has high expression of a certain target. So I explain it's chemotherapy directed more specifically to the tumor.
And Dr. MacArthur, in breast cancer I feel like is probably lung as well, has gotten so complex. There's so many different therapeutics, oral medications, endocrine things, chemotherapies, now antibody-drug conjugates. Do you have a different kind of paradigm when you're discussing these with your patients?
I think the approach is very similar to what Dr. Guerin just described, which is emphasizing that you get this high drug delivery. So the DAR, which you see on a lot of the slides, drug to antibody ratio, speaks to the incredibly high dose that we can deliver with this mechanism that you could never administer intravenously. So it allows us to give much higher doses. And the antibodies are ideally targeting antigens that are uniquely expressed to tumor tissue. So it limits the off-target toxicity.
Yeah, I'm going to just for the audience, I'm going to switch to first names just because we're going to have a conversation up here. So I'm going to go to Jamie.
How I describe them to patients is like a package of mail. The label is your antibody. It's telling you where you need to go to deliver that package. And your package is your payload or the chemotherapy. So the mail person is delivering the package. Your package is your payload. It's trying to find the cancer. The cancer is the house. You deliver that package, and then the payload, it opens, and then the cancer is killed by the drug, the chemotherapy agent that's being delivered.
Yep. Cordy, any comments?
I have a pretty similar approach. I try to keep it very simple. I just tell our patients this is a targeted therapy, and they like hearing that because it's a little bit different than what they've received in the past. And I tell them there's three components. You have this antibody, and then you have the payload. And I tell them this is the cytotoxic or kind of the chemotherapy part to it, and then you have a linker that connects the two. So this antibody is binding to something, and depending on which ADC we're prescribing, I kind of explain to them why we're targeting that. And then it's linked to the chemo, and then the chemo releases within the cell wall, causing cell death. And so just breaking it down very simple and using very basic terms, the patients seem to understand it. And they like the word targeted therapy.
And so when we're not going to be able to go through, it's like we use different terms, a tsunami of antibody drug conjugates, an avalanche of antibody drug conjugates, all these synonyms. There's so many under development. We're not going to get to them all today, but I'm going to show you the current approved antibody drug conjugates. We will talk about a lot of these, and you can see them listed here, and then we're going to talk about so many that are under development. So it's an exciting time for our patients with solid and hematologic tumors in terms of agents under study for their particular cancers. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Heather to talk about the current and future role of HER2 targeting ADCs in breast cancer. Take it away.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you to the organizers for including me in this terrific meeting. This is a very hopeful time to be treating breast cancer. We have had an unprecedented number of FDA approvals for new drugs, and antibody drug conjugates are certainly leading the way. So we'll talk about HER2 targeting antibody drug conjugates here. Later, we'll focus on the TROP2 directed antibody drug conjugates. And as a breast oncologist, I'm sort of proud that we were the first group to the table, and that T-DM1 was the first antibody drug conjugate that was approved. That was back in 2013. But it's not a particularly novel idea, and it's interesting to me that 100 years prior, Paul Ehrlich actually described this idea of targeted therapy, but it took us 100 years to actually realize that targeted therapy for cancer. And you can see in the box below there a huge number of antibody drug conjugates that have since been approved for a variety of indications in breast cancer specifically. So these are the drugs that are available currently for the treatment of breast cancer. We're going to focus on the first two in this part of the presentation, which are the HER2-directed antibody drug conjugates, trastuzumab deruxtecan and trastuzumab emtansine, or T-DM1. Again, T-DM1 has been around since 2013. They have different payloads, so we talked a little bit about the mechanism of action. They have different payloads, and what I think is really game-changing in terms of the novel antibody drug conjugates is this bystander effect. So one of the biggest challenges in the treatment of HER2-positive breast cancer has been this issue of heterogeneity. And so trastuzumab deruxtecan, and we'll talk about this in HER2-positive, but also HER2-low and ultra-low patients, the idea is that even with the smallest amount of HER2 expression, that you can target cytotoxic therapy, and with a bystander effect, you can overcome this challenge of heterogeneity, which has been a huge clinical challenge for us in the past. So trastuzumab deruxtecan has been evaluated in a number of DESTINY-Breast studies. I inherited somebody from the DESTINY-Breast01 study, so the first study looking at trastuzumab deruxtecan. She had brain metastasis. She was on this drug for 7 years before she progressed, and she was without evaluable disease. So it really did revolutionize how we think about HER2-positive disease. So whenever we see benefit in patients who have heavily pretreated disease, we typically try and move those same strategies up earlier in the course of disease, and that's what the DESTINY-Breast09 study aimed to do. It went head-to-head against our standard of care, which was the Cleopatra THP regimen, which you probably, if you treat breast cancer, would be familiar with. That's been our standard of care for over a decade. And it went head-to-head against THP with antibody drug conjugate trastuzumab deruxtecan and pertuzumab here with a primary endpoint of progression-free survival. And you can see a radical, almost 14-month improvement in progression-free survival. HER2-positive disease used to be the most aggressive type of breast cancer, and now you're seeing responses more than 3 years to first-line therapy. So that is wildly impactful in this patient population. Hazard ratio here is 0.56. I don't know if you've talked about hazard ratios a lot, but you just look at the reverse number, so 100 minus the 0.56, which means that there's a 44% reduction in progression. So that's how you interpret hazard ratios with these Kaplan-Meier curves. So that was game-changing, and it was a benefit that was seen regardless of subtype. So every single subtype, you don't need to read the slide, but the point is that every single subtype of breast cancer that was interrogated derived benefit from this approach. So again, whenever we see benefit in the metastatic setting, we typically move those strategies earlier and earlier in the course of disease. So that was a first-line study, DESTINY-Breast09. What about applying those same strategies in the curative intent setting? And that's what DESTINY-Breast11 aimed to do. So it took patients with stage 2 or stage 3 HER2-positive disease and randomized them to neoadjuvant therapy, which is our current standard of care. Patients either received dose-dense ACTHP or T-DXd followed by THP. There was an arm that had T-DXd exclusively, but it was closed early on in the course of the study because it didn't meet efficacy endpoint. So all the data that you'll see is really the head-to-head dose-dense ACTHP versus T-DXd followed by THP. So can we eliminate anthracycline administration? And they showed at meeting this past year that there was an improvement more than 11% in pathologic complete response in favor of the T-DXd. We know from the FDA and other meta-analyses that for HER2-positive disease, pathologic complete response rates are very highly correlated with curability of disease. So this seems like a very impactful and promising response here. And the benefit was seen regardless of hormone receptor status. Not surprisingly, a little bit more magnified for patients with hormone receptor disease, hormone receptor negative disease. We see that consistently, but a benefit as well in our hormone receptor positive, triple positive population. And then at the same ESMO meeting, we saw another study that was presented, DESTINY-Breast05. So this looked at adjuvant residual disease. So the DESTINY-Breast11 study that I just showed you was neoadjuvant therapy. Here you're looking at the patients who have residual disease. So those patients who don't achieve a complete response, those patients are at very high risk of distant recurrence. Can we improve on the standard of care, T-DM1? And that's what this study aimed to do. So T-DM1 versus trastuzumab deruxtecan in this very high-risk population. And again, you see improvement in invasive disease-free survival, which means improvement, almost 10% improvement in curability of disease with this approach. We can argue about whether, since I just showed you a neoadjuvant approach with trastuzumab deruxtecan and adjuvant approach, we have a lot of debate within our community about whether you should offer T-DXd to everybody up front or should you hold off and only offer it to those patients who have residual disease. And we're not totally aligned in our community about best approach in this moment. Again, you don't need to read the slide. You can just see that very consistent benefits were observed regardless of subgroup interrogated. And what I mentioned up front, which was you don't necessarily need to have HER2-positive disease, right? You need to have some level of HER2 expression. HER2 testing was not developed to look at low levels of HER2 expression. It was developed to look at HER2 positivity. So we're struggling a little bit in identifying patients with HER2 low and even patients with HER2 ultra low, because you can have a HER2 zero result by IHC, but that just means that you haven't met 10% of cell threshold for the 1+ designation, but you could still have 9% of cells that have HER2 expression and be in that HER2 zero category. So again, one of the attractive features of these drugs is this bystander effect. So you just need a handful of cells potentially that have some level of HER2 expression, and then the payload is released into the environment and kills cells even if they don't have that HER2 expression. And we've seen that in breast cancer. The DESTINY-Breast06 study is a study that enrolled patients with HER2-low or HER2-ultra-low, again, not zero per se, but a little bit of expression, and randomized them to standard of care. And the DESTINY-Breast04 also enrolled patients who had HER2-low disease and randomized them and compared to standard of care chemotherapy. And you can see progression-free survival and overall survival. So trastuzumab deruxtecan has become a standard of care in HER2-positive disease, in HER2-low, and even HER2-ultra-low disease. And it has changed our conversation with pathology about how to best report results for this patient population. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I think you're going to hear a theme. If you, but those of you that take care of our patients, you've already heard about T-DXd. We're all like trying to use it all the time. So I'm going to talk about it, and I think Dr. Guerin's going to talk about it. But with our like excitement about this comes the things that you hear about. What are our patients saying? What are you monitoring for? How does our nursing APP partners help take care of patients on these medications? So I'm going to turn over to Jamie Carroll, who's going to take us through, what do we have to worry about from a cardiac standpoint?
Thanks. As we've talked about, you know, trastuzumab deruxtecan is across all, it's pan-tumor approved, so we're using a lot of it. But then we also have to know how it's affecting our patients and what side effects to look out for. So I'm going to talk through potential for cardiac toxicity. So how common is it? So clinical trials show that the reported incidence is pretty low, but it's definitely still something that we monitor for and we screen for. So reported incidence of left ventricular ejection fraction, the decrease or the change, occurs 1% with T-DM1 and 4-5% with trastuzumab deruxtecan. Thankfully, most is asymptomatic and reversible if you're needing to dose interrupt. So I think it's important that we understand what's the baseline cardiac assessment of our patients. So we need to get a baseline either echo or a MUGA scan. An echo is going to give a comprehensive amount of information. And if you are able to get a strain, that is also helpful. I tell patients the difference between an ejection fraction and a strain, because most know what ejection fraction is. Strain is looking at the teeny muscle fibers, and so typically you're going to see a change in the strain before you see a change in the ejection fraction. So I get both of those, and it's on the same order. So it's important to talk to your and understand the patient history. So are they at an increased risk of having changes in their ejection fraction when you're giving them these therapies? So are they greater than 60 years of age? Do they have underlying hypertension? Maybe they have diabetes. Did they get a prior anthracycline? Because we know that anthracyclines can cause cardiomyopathy down the road. So you have to look back at their history. Maybe they had breast cancer 20 years ago and they got an anthracycline. They're at increased risk. And then is their baseline, once you get the echo, is their baseline ejection fraction less than 60%? And then it's important that we're seeing these patients every 3 weeks and understanding if there's any concerning findings. So for a follow-up echo, concerning findings would be a drop in ejection fraction greater than or equal to 10%, what the lower limit of normal is. Things that patients could tell you that are concerning for a change in their cardiac function is new or worsening dyspnea, fatigue that you can't relate it to anything else, if they've got new peripheral edema, if they have chest discomfort. But most patients are asymptomatic, and it's really important that we continue to get those every 3 month echocardiograms. So when we're seeing these patients for follow up in the clinic or maybe in the infusion center, we're double checking and making sure that the patient had that echo ordered and that the patient went to it. So cardiac monitoring is routine and evidence-based. So sometimes patients say, well, why are you doing this? Are you worried about something for me? And so it's important to just say, no, we do this for everyone. We get this every 3 month echocardiogram. We'll try to get it on the same day that you're here for appointments so that they're not having additional visits to the clinic. And that most changes are asymptomatic and they're reversible. Instruct your patients to let you know if they have any new cardiac or respiratory symptoms, and then adherence to those scheduled exams is important. Okay, so let's say you have a patient and their repeat echo, their ejection fraction dropped. So you're holding treatment, but now what do you do? So it's important to understand what you do when you hold treatment and then when it's okay to restart their therapies. So it's okay to restart when their ejection fraction increases to greater than 50% or their baseline if the patient is now asymptomatic. Generally, we don't need to dose reduce the actual medicine that caused the ejection fraction reduction, typically an interruption and then consults with multidisciplinary team is indicated. And then you might want to reconsider shorter interval echocardiograms in the future. But utilizing the multidisciplinary team is really important. I am not a cardiologist, so it's important that I get help from a cardiology team to say, what do I do when I have this drug that's reducing my patient's ejection fraction? Help me. So for my patient, so I have a case study here. So I have a 40-year-old female in 2023. She had a screening mammogram that showed a spiculated mass in her breast measuring 2 centimeters. Ultrasound measured it at 1.6, and then she also had enlarged lymph nodes. Biopsy was completed, which showed an invasive ductal carcinoma. It was grade 3. The estrogen and progesterone receptors were negative. The HER2 was 3+, and then she was lymph node positive. So because she had lymph node positivity, we got a staging PET scan to say, if the cancer has already gone to the lymph node, did it go somewhere else in the body? And the PET scan showed the known cancer that we knew about in the breast and the lymph node, and then unfortunately suspicious areas in her liver and her bones. We did a brain MRI, which was negative. This is her initial staging PET scan. So for those of you that aren't familiar with PET scans, the brain lights up, that has metabolic uptake, the bladder, which is that white blob at the bottom, that shows up. Sometimes you can see the heart, sometimes you can see kidneys, but kind of those scattered white areas around, you can see her underlying liver, but those scattered white areas, those are all cancer. So we did germline genetics. She was young. It was negative. And we started her on first-line treatment. So March of 2023, she started docetaxel, trastuzumab, and pertuzumab. Now, typically, you start paclitaxel. This patient lived 10 hours from our infusion center, and so instead of having a weekly treatment, she wanted to come the least amount as possible. So we switched her to docetaxel, so she only had to come every 3 weeks, which was really helpful for her. She's actually a chemotherapy infusion nurse and wanted to continue working. So her initial echocardiogram showed an ejection fraction of 65%, and her strain is negative 18%. Normal strain is anything more negative than negative 18%. So she continued on her treatments. 3 months in, we dropped the docetaxel, and she continued on maintenance, trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And then about 18 months later, she messaged us and said, I'm having loss of motor control in one of my hands, and I feel weaker than I did before. So we got a brain MRI, and unfortunately, she had a 3.5 centimeter brain met that she underwent resection and then radiation to that surgical cavity. This is a photo of her brain MRIs, so you can see that whitish area kind of in the center there. That was her brain met. So then she started on TDXD or trastuzumab deruxtecan. Baseline echo there, EF 60%, strain negative 20%. And we continued every 3 months checking her ejection fraction. In July of 25, her repeat echo showed a drop in ejection fraction from 60 to 50. And then her strain went down to negative 16%. So I put through both a cardio-oncology consult and an e-consult because I wanted to see which one I could get quicker because I wanted to try to help my patient. I wanted to keep her on treatment if I could. And so typically, cardio-oncology consults are way out, and I knew I could probably get her in quicker if I did an econ. The challenge with an econ is guess who's responsible for the recommendations? Me. So we started her on, we continued on her TDXD, and then the econ wanted us to start carvedilol, 3.125 milligrams twice a day, slowly titrate up to a max dose of 25 milligrams twice daily as tolerated. So she got a blood pressure cuff at home, checked her blood pressure and her pulse because I wanted to make sure that those weren't dropping as we were increasing the carvedilol. And then the econ also suggested repeating the echo in 3 months. So her repeat echo showed the EF had come up to 57% and her strain had improved to negative 18%. At that time, she was on carvedilol 12.5 milligrams twice a day, but she had occasional mild dizziness, but her blood pressure and her pulse remained normal. The cardio-oncology consult finally happened. So we're talking like 3 months later, right? So it finally happened. They said, okay, she's got some mild dizziness. Let's see if we can decrease the carvedilol. So we went down to 6.25 milligrams twice a day. And then they also recommended adding in echo and then some labs every 3 months. So every 6 weeks, she either had labs or an echo. And then her repeat echo, things had improved just a little bit more, and her EF is 57% and strain negative 20%. So for this particular patient, even though she had a reduction in her ejection fraction on the TDXD, we were able to continue the therapy. We didn't have to hold. We were able to optimize her cardiac function by starting carvedilol, and she was able to maintain a therapy that was working for her breast cancer.
All right, we're going to try and get back to some questions and discussion around these side effects, but let's talk about a few more available options with antibody-drug conjugates. So I'm going to take us through currently available antibody-drug conjugates in a gynecologic cancer space. And there's so many targets under development and under study. They're not even all listed here, but I'm going to start with the one that is FDA approved, which is folate receptor alpha. This has now been incorporated into testing really for all of our patients with ovarian cancer, either at diagnosis or at the time of a subsequent biopsy. And the positivity rate you can see on the right-hand side of your screen, we find some folate receptor alpha expression. This is mainly high-grade serous tumors. In about 80%, we'll find some. But we'll find high expression, which is what's tied to availability of mirvetuximab, in almost 40%. And high is defined by both staining intensity, which is either 2+ or 3+, and the percentage of cells that are positive. So to be folate receptor alpha high, 75% or greater of the cells on a slide have to have 2+ or 3+ staining intensity, and that hits about 40% of tumors. The antibody-drug conjugate that is approved is called mirvetuximab. It's been studied in several studies. I'm only going to show you Mirasol, which was a randomized phase 3 trial in the platinum-resistant setting. Patients' tumors had to be folate receptor alpha high. They could have 1 to 3 prior lines of cumulative therapy, and they were randomized 1-to-1 to receive mirvetuximab, which is given IV every 3 weeks, or a investigator's choice chemotherapy. And this was presented in 2024, or approved in 2024, presented in 2023, and is the first novel therapy ever in the history of platinum-resistant ovarian cancer to improve both progression-free and overall survival. We had never done that before, and it does show what we can do. About a 30+% reduction in the rate of progression events and a 32% reduction in the rate of death events for patients that were treated with mirvetuximab as compared to investigator's choice chemotherapy. The safety profile of mirvetuximab is unique. It's differentiated. You heard my colleagues talk about how these are envelopes delivered to a tumor cell. I describe them as Trojan horses. Sometimes people call them magic bullets. They're not quite magic, but they are delivering a payload of chemotherapy to a tumor cell, and so you're avoiding a lot of the normal cells, not none. And so we do see on-target off-tumor toxicity, so if the target's on a normal cell, you can hit it. or we see off-target, off-tumor, where we just can't quite understand completely why the drug is causing certain toxicities. With mirvetuximab, the toxicity that we see that is unusual is ocular. And so on the clinical trial, about 50% of patients had some ocular disturbance. Dry eye, blurry vision, keratopathy is the diagnosis that the ophthalmologist or optometrist would give us. Happened around cycle 3. We mitigate with eye drops, both steroids and lubricating or preservative-free lubricating eye drops. And so these are mainly low-grade and 100% reversible, although we are following that now that this drug is in the wild. We're going to see, you know, really what happens. And so we may pivot on some of those estimates. So we're very cautious around the eye toxicity, but it is reversible and doesn't happen continuously. Once it happens and we mitigate, it tends to not happen again. We can see nausea, we can see diarrhea, and so we need to have appropriate mitigation strategies for these toxicities as well. And the payload of mirvetuximab is something called DM4, which is a microtubule toxin. It is not paclitaxel, and this medication works post-paclitaxel, but it does cause neuropathy. Not as much as paclitaxel, but not that much less either. And so we do have to monitor for this as a side effect and dose hold when appropriate. So the things we watch for with MIRV are eyes, nerves, and then GI. Very little hematologic toxicity, though, which is nice. For cervical cancer, I want to turn to the other FDA-approved medications. We are grateful that there's drug development in cervical cancer. We've made dramatic strides with the incorporation of immunotherapy and anti-angiogenic therapies into frontline metastatic, so paclitaxel, carboplatin, immune checkpoint inhibitor, bevacizumab, improved overall survival, but at recurrence, we really had nothing effective until tisotumab. So tisotumab is an antibody-drug conjugate that targets tissue factor. Tissue factor is so common, we don't even have to test for it. And it has another type of microtubule toxin on its tail called MMAE. And this was the study that demonstrated an improvement in overall survival for patients with second-line and beyond metastatic cervical cancer treated with tisotumab versus standard of care agents, which I'm just going to say are largely placebo in terms of efficacy. But this was a major accomplishment for our patients. And this is just what you expect with investigator's choice chemotherapy. It's just almost unethical to use. And then, of course, T-DXd, we've heard a lot about today, so I don't have to belabor what it is. We gained access to it in 2024 because of Destiny Pan Tumor, which had 3 gynecologic cohorts. You can see the positivity rate for 3+ across gynecologic cancers is pretty low, except in uterine cancer, where we can find it pretty commonly. 2+ is more common. And so we've seen, because of Destiny Pan Tumor, the now tissue agnostic approval by the FDA for 3+. And we're looking for this in basically every patient we see. And so we can stop and take a few discussion questions. And I'm going to pick on Courtney a little bit because I know she takes care of gynecologic cancers. What do you think, you know, mirvetuximab in the wild now, tisotumab in the wild now, you had the clinical trials open. How are patients doing when you're using these medications kind of as standard of care? What do you notice from them?
Overall, they're tolerating it pretty well. I think we learned a lot in the clinical trials. You know, the ocular toxicities were new to us when we first started studying both of these ADCs. I think we've implemented some mitigation strategies to reduce the risk of ocular toxicities. And it's funny, all of the, you know, conversations are generally around ocular toxicities, but more often we're seeing fatigue, peripheral neuropathy that we're having to manage for these patients. For the most part, it's mild AEs that we're able to manage with either holding treatment short-term or just other mitigation strategies with medications, physical therapy, things like that. So overall, our patients are tolerating it pretty well. Most commonly with these ADCs, we're seeing fatigue and neuropathy, and then, of course, the ocular toxicities. But clinically, I don't feel like we're seeing as much ocular toxicity as we did on the clinical trials.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about those. You're going to take it away for ocular toxicities in a moment. But just before we go there, Heather, I mean, you have, I think all of our breast cancer medical oncology experts have taught us how to use T-DXd safely. As it's moved now into lung and gyne and biliary tract, are there any different symptoms that we should be watching for? Is there anything that's tumor-specific with T-DXd, or is it the same toxicities that you all have been telling us about the whole time?
I think the key is to identify radiographic grade 1 interstitial lung disease. We still, even on our most modern studies, we've still had fatal interstitial lung disease. And we have data from the breast cancer space showing that you can re-challenge patients who have grade 1, which is asymptomatic interstitial lung disease. So it's only radiographic. You pause, you treat, and you can re-challenge successfully. Once it becomes symptomatic, though, you have to permanently discontinue. So that vigilance is incredibly important. So typically with other therapeutic strategies, we scan every 3 months. With trastuzumab deruxtecan, we're scanning every 9 weeks, so after every 3 cycles, to try and identify those grade 1 ILD cases.
Right. And we have a whole section on ILD that we're going to come back to, and the differences in management for grade 1 can be confusing, so we'll touch on that point. But I want to turn it over to Courtney Arn to talk about ocular toxicities. Take it away.
Okay. Thank you. All right, so now we're going to talk about ocular toxicities with ADCs. Depending on which ADC you're giving, the ocular toxicities can vary a little bit. But in general, ADC-associated ocular toxicities are surface ocular disease. So most commonly, we're seeing dry eyes, blurred vision, keratitis or keratopathy, and conjunctivitis. So it's important to know which ADC you're giving and which most common ocular toxicities we're seeing. Patient education is really, really important. Patients hear that it can cause ocular toxicity or changes to their vision, and they immediately assume that they're going to have severe vision changes or even go blind. And so I'm not saying minimize the conversation with them, but make sure you're reassuring them. What we saw in the clinical trials were pretty much grade 1 ocular toxicities, and most of the patients had either complete resolution or significant improvement within 30 days of stopping therapy. So educating your patients on what to expect. Also, signs and symptoms to report. Some patients think, okay, it causes eye toxicity, so I'm not supposed to call. This is normal. They still need to call and let you know if they're having those ocular toxicities. Also, talk to them about what to be expected as far as the eye exams and monitoring. This is something different for our patients. You know, they're used to getting their labs, their CT scans, but eye exams is a little bit different. So make sure they're aware of when they need to go see the eye care provider. I print out, because again, with different ADCs, the regimen's a little bit different. I print out the ocular assessment form and say, you know, if it's every cycle, I give them one for every cycle to take in. If it's every other, I print cycle 1, cycle 3, cycle 5, give it to the patients. They know they need to take that to their eye care provider. They bring it back to their visit. We make sure that their eye care provider has filled it out. We have all the information that we need to know if we can treat them that day or if we need to modify their dose. Just letting them know, though, about these eye exams and what to expect at the eye exams really helps alleviate some of the anxiety related to it. And then lastly, you want to educate them on the eye drops. You want to make sure they're aware that they need to use the eye drops. You want to make sure that they've picked up their prescriptions. Some of the ADCs in the gyn-onc space, they have to start the eye drops the day before their treatment. So it's not something that you can counsel them on that cycle one, day one visit. You want to make sure ahead of time you've talked to them about the eye drops, they have them, and they know how to use it. I've really found that cycle one, day one visit is a really good time to educate your patients on how to use the eye drops. A lot of our patients have never had to use eye drops before, and it seems simple, but as a non-healthcare provider, you know, it might not be common sense to them. So just make sure you're talking them through how to use it. We've definitely seen a reduction in the ocular toxicities with implementing some prophylactic measures or mitigation strategies. The baseline eye exam is really important. We use this with a grain of salt. You know, if they go to an eye doctor and the doctor's, I've had one time where the eye care provider's like, they have cataracts, maybe use something else. They don't understand, you know, how hard it is to treat some of these oncology patients, and there might not be another treatment option for them. So get the baseline eye exam, make sure that there's not any significant contraindication to them starting therapy or being on the eye drops. Preservative-free artificial tears or lubricating eye drops has significantly reduced the dry eyes, which is one of the most common ocular toxicities that we see with ADCs. So by using the lubricating eye drops, we can prevent some of the toxicities and significantly improve those AEs as well. So make sure your patients have them, they know how to use them, make sure that they're preservative-free. The topical corticosteroid eye drops are a little bit controversial. We did start implementing them, and now there's actually an ongoing clinical trial that's looking at if the steroid eye drops are actually needed or not, or if they're potentially increasing risk of cataract or other ocular conditions. So there's some mixed evidence on this, getting some more information, but right now one of the ADCs for gyn does have steroid eye drops implemented. And then some ADCs have vasoconstrictor eye drops. This kind of constricts the blood flow, which ultimately reduces the risk of ocular toxicities. This is one of those that they put in their eyes prior to getting their infusion to decrease the risk of ocular toxicities. So it's really important to know which ADC you're giving, which ocular toxicities it can cause, and which eye drops are required. And then some also have ice packs or cooling pads that they can put. Same concept. It kind of blocks the blood flow to their eyes to decrease the risk of having the ocular toxicities. A really big teaching point as healthcare providers, we have to talk to our patients that they cannot wear contact lenses. It's not just during their infusion, but the entire time they're on this ADC therapy, they can't wear contacts. Some patients don't have prescription glasses, and so if you tell them when they come in to start their treatment, they might not have an alternative method to be able to see. So make sure you're counseling your patients ahead of time that they're not allowed to wear contact lenses while they're receiving therapy. Essentially, it can significantly increase the risk of having ocular toxicities, so make sure your patients are aware of this. And it's something that they can talk to their eye care provider at that baseline eye exam about, too. Supportive care includes frequent monitoring during therapy. Again, depending on the ADC, baseline eye exam, some are every other, some are every for the first 9 cycles, some are every 3 cycles. Just make sure you're aware of what your treatment regimen is required for the eye care exams and make sure your patients are aware. And then make sure that you have some method in place to make sure that your patient has gone to get their eye exam and you have those results before they come in for their treatment. Really, we're not having to modify dose very often because of ocular toxicity. But because it is a surface disease, it resolves very quickly. So even holding therapy for 1 week, we can see pretty significant improvement. So if there's any concern, you know, should we treat today, should we not, give them a week off, let them improve, and most of the time they'll come back in a week later and their ocular toxicities have improved. There's a great dose modification that I'll have at the end of this that can kind of help determine whether you hold, dose reduce, or discontinue. And then lastly is using the multidisciplinary approach. In oncology, we've kind of gotten used to managing everything, right? Like, we're managing thyroid, we're managing blood pressures. There's no reason we should be trying to manage these ocular toxicities. Our job in the oncology space is to know which ADCs can cause ocular toxicities, what those ocular toxicities are, and make sure your patients are going to their eye care provider and you're working closely with that eye care provider to make sure that they're getting the right exams and eye drops. If there's any concern, communicating with the eye care provider, you know, about holding, dose reducing, but having that multidisciplinary approach is really, really helpful. Some patients require long-term follow-up, but again, most of our patients have significant improvement or complete resolution, but just utilizing that multidisciplinary approach to educate the patient and make sure you're taking good care of them.
So before we get to Dr. Guerin and or Eddie and talking about lung cancer, just one question on sort of for our team in the room who get the call from these patients, what are they calling with? What are they saying is happening? And what's kind of your first step when they call with any kind of ocular side effect, Courtney? Oh, I'm not asking you, Courtney.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were talking to him.
I said I'm going to get to him next.
Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. I misunderstood that. Really, we're not getting a lot of calls. What we see most commonly is they come in for their treatment. You ask them, and they're like, well, sometimes it's a little bit blurry at home, but we're not having very many calls come in about the ocular toxicities. And then sometimes our patients are not having any symptoms at all, but you get their ocular assessment form, and the eye care provider actually notes, you know, that they have a very mild keratitis or keratopathy. Sometimes our patients, specifically on tisotumab vedotin, will call with like a little bit of like a redness or a crustiness around their eyes, specifically when they wake up in the morning. And then some have dry eyes. But most of the patients with the dry eyes, it's so mild that they're not even calling in. It's just when you straight up ask them, like, do your eyes dry? They're like, yeah, they're a little bit dry. But for the most part, the symptoms are so mild and intermittent that we're not getting a lot of calls about the ocular toxicities.
Yeah. And I think this is a largely, if not entirely, U.S.-based audience. One of the other just tidbits for those of you that haven't done this yet, these patients can be seen by optometry. They don't have to go to an ophthalmologist. An optometrist is usually completely fine, and they can go to Walmart where the copays are really low. I take care of a lot of patients with financial insecurity, and so that's just a little tip to keep in your back pocket and get them in the same day, and they can get seen without tremendous financial toxicity. But with that, let's move it to Eddie Guerin and lung cancer. Take it away, sir.
Well, thank you very much. And in many respects, the antibody drug conjugates have not perhaps taken over the management of lung cancer to the same extent as has been true in some other malignancies. But there are three molecularly defined approved antibody drug conjugates, and we will talk about those. So first I'll give a case. So this is a 57-year-old woman who I've cared for several years. These cases are always a little gratifying to me. Early in my career, I sort of was running a pre-hospice service in my lung cancer clinic, and now we do have not infrequent patients who were diagnosed 7 years earlier. In this case, the patient, it's a little unusual of a story, diagnosed with what was at the time considered stage 3 disease with an EGFR mutation. But during chemoradiotherapy, for some reason, an imaging of the brain was obtained at an outside facility where she was being treated, and a brain metastasis was found. So she received stereotactic radiation at that time. Got durvalumab as maintenance, a PD-L1 inhibitor, and then at progression, she received osimertinib, our standard frontline therapy for EGFR mutant disease. She did develop pneumonitis at that time. This is a known complication of these two drugs being given together, but she was able to wean her steroids and continue with therapy. Eventually went on to chemotherapy, but now has experienced progression on standard chemotherapy. So again, there are three approved antibody drug conjugates that are relevant in lung cancer. One we'll be talking about more later as well, which is datopotamab deruxtecan. This is an antibody drug conjugate that targets TROP2, which is known to be present disproportionately in many cancers, including lung cancer. There was a randomized study that looked at datopotamab deruxtecan versus docetaxel in non-small cell lung cancer. Docetaxel is a standard second-line chemotherapeutic, and when one looked at the adverse event profile, they were different. There certainly are adverse events that are seen with both, and we'll discuss this more later, whereas docetaxel tended to have sort of more neuropathy. You tended to have more mucositis, ocular events, as well as the concerns of interstitial lung disease. And again, we'll talk a little more later about the toxicities of datopotamab deruxtecan. In terms of progression-free survival, you had these somewhat unusual curves where you actually had patients who had squamous disease, sort of one of our more common subgroupings of non-small cell lung cancer, where actually the docetaxel outperformed the datopotamab deruxtecan. On the other hand, our more common non-squamous disease, the datopotamab deruxtecan was better than docetaxel. This was a randomized study, but did not lead to approval overall in the disease, in part because of the survival curves you see here, which show really very similar survival between patients who were randomized to datopotamab deruxtecan or docetaxel. But you'll see that there at least are suggestions of benefits in subgroups. One, those patients who had non-squamous disease, and in particularly in those who had what are now being described as actionable genomic alterations. These are a set of different mutations that are commonly seen in lung cancer patients that really direct their therapy. The great majority of these patients have a mutation in the EGFR gene. And so there was also another study that was run that was exclusively for these patients, again, looking at different actionable genomic alterations, but this is mostly patients with EGFR mutations. And you can see these impressive waterfall plots for those of you who are not used to looking at a waterfall plot. What you can see here is on the y-axis, you are seeing the best percentage of radiographic change. So if you have 100% down, that means that really you don't see any radiographic evidence of disease at this point. And as you can see, there was a significant efficacy in this actual genomic alteration population, particularly patients with EGFR mutations. And this does now have an accelerated approval by the US FDA for treatment of EGFR mutant non-small cell lung cancer. We're going to shift to HER2. This is looking at sort of a biomarker and an oncogene that has been discussed before, but it's a little bit different in lung cancer than it is in breast cancer, for instance. So the gene is still the gene, but in breast cancer, you tend to have amplification or more copies of the HER2 gene. That rarely happens in lung cancer, probably less than 1%. You do have 1% to 2% of patients where you have a de novo mutation in the HER2 gene, which is not particularly common in breast cancer, not as common as the amplification, but where there's a mutation in HER2. And similarly, there are about 3% of cases of non-small cell lung cancer where you have high protein staining or immunohistochemical staining for HER2. So although each of these abnormalities is on its own somewhat rare, when you add up the 2% and the 1% and the 3%, it is a non-trivial percentage of patients with lung cancer. And as has already been mentioned, trastuzumab deruxtecan does have an approval across tumors for patients who have HER2 3+ staining. This is a little bit of an unusual approval in that the number of patients who you had data on at the time of approval was quite low. So again, looking at the response rate, 30% is considered a response. The response rate was quite good, but you're really talking about a handful of patients here. So I would say the overall degree of efficacy is somewhat unknown. We have more robust data in the patients who have mutations in the HER2 gene, and trastuzumab deruxtecan was approved in previously treated patients with HER2 mutations based on this data. This, I will move on. This is just a slide to show that although early studies looked at a higher dosing than what is used in breast cancer and other diseases, the approval is based on the same dosing as used in other histologies. So this is the last biomarker-specific antibody drug conjugate that is currently approved in patients with lung cancer. Here you can see this is tulisatuzumab vedotin or Tuliso-V, and this again is an accelerated approval based on a relatively small study of single arm patients. What you can see here is again, you see on the left, you see these waterfall plots that I previously described. On the right, you can see the response rate. And what you can see is that in these patients without EGFR mutations, which is the main population they were looking at, over a third of patients had a response when they had what was considered high staining for c-MET, or 3+ staining in half of the cells. This has led to an approval of Tuliso-V in this population of previously treated patients who have high staining for MET. As you can imagine, I didn't say it before, but Tuliso-V is an antibody drug conjugate directed against MET. Tulisatuzumab targets MET. Here you can see the progression-free survival curve and overall survival curve. As would be expected, particularly for overall survival, the best results were in these patients who had c-MET high. But just to make it clear to people, these are comparing in a single-arm study patients who had high-level staining for c-MET versus intermediate staining, and we do not yet have randomized studies versus a comparator. Those studies are ongoing, and we hopefully will have data on that in the coming months to years. So to go back to the case, the patient did choose to initiate therapy with datopotamab deruxtecan. There was some concern. One of the things that had been very meaningful to this patient is in the 7 years to date, no one was able to tell that she had cancer based on management with osimertinib and then carboplatin pemetrexed. In some cases, you have hair loss with datopotamab deruxtecan and was of concern to the patient. Fortunately, she tolerated it quite well, little mucositis and no problems. problems with pneumonitis. I sometimes like presenting cases that are in gray zones because these are the clinical challenges that we are faced with. This patient did have a history of pneumonitis, but a history of pneumonitis based on the combination of two drugs that, or at least close proximity of two drugs that we know when given close together cause pneumonitis. Whether or not that is an absolute contraindication or not is hard to know, but we don't really have much data. But she, despite the history of pneumonitis, she did receive the drug and has not had pneumonitis. She didn't have a robust tumor reduction volume, but really did have sort of a slight improvement in stability now over several months and continues to do well, although did receive stereotactic radiation. For many of these agents, including datopotamab deruxtecan, there may be some activity in the central nervous system, but it tends to be variable, with some patients having clear evidence of activity in the brain and some patients having progression that is specifically in the central nervous system.
So that was wonderful. We're a little bit behind on time, but I wanted to make sure we did get to one question around kind of non-small cell lung cancer and how you're thinking about things. So can you just clarify, we're going to get back to the toxicity, so we'll skip that one for now, but the first question around sort of who of your EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer tumors, patients with those tumors, where are you using Dato-DXd?
Yeah, I think for most of us we're using it after frontline chemotherapy-based approaches. Historically, we have used a lot of single-agent osimertinib followed by platinum-based chemotherapy, sometimes continuing the osimertinib in those cases. More recently in those patients, there is the potential for adding this drug amivantamab to the chemotherapy. Amivantamab does clearly improve the efficacy of the chemotherapy, but does come at a real cost from a toxicity perspective. And so, for instance, in the patient that I noted, that patient chose not to receive amivantamab because of her concerns related to the toxicity. And in general, where we tend to be prioritizing it is when we would otherwise be looking, for instance, at docetaxel, at chemotherapy, sort of second-line chemotherapy. But the truth is that patients with EGFR mutation-positive lung cancer now are getting several different therapies over time. And I would say most patients now are at some point in their care going to receive these therapies. And there are also ongoing studies that will help us prioritize at which point in the patient's journey this is the appropriate choice.
Yeah, so it's not really an if, it's when. When are you going to use it? It's not an either or. It's like where in the sequence is sort of a lot of us are dealing with. Yeah. Okay. Heather, I'm turning it back over to you to talk about TROP2 in breast cancer.
Thank you. There we go. Okay, so we currently have three TROP2 targeting antibody drug conjugates, sacituzumab govitecan, datopotamab deruxtecan, which you just heard about, and sacituzumab tivumotecan, or sac-TMT, which is the last one to the arena. Why target TROP2? So TROP2 is ubiquitously expressed. More than 80% of breast cancers express TROP2. So it makes a great target for an antibody drug conjugate. And again, with this bystander effect, not all the cells need to express the TROP2. You just need to have some population of TROP2 expressing cells. We talked about earlier the drug to antibody ratio. Again, this type of approach allows you to give much higher doses of chemotherapy linked, obviously, to the antibody here, but much higher than we could give intravenously, and has really changed pretty much every subtype of breast cancer, the natural history. So let's look at some of the data. So I just mentioned TROP2 is a therapeutic target. It makes sense because the majority of cancers, breast cancers specifically, express TROP2. I've highlighted the triple negative and in the first red box and then the triple negative with the HER2 low because that's obviously an intersection here. It makes sense because it's a panepithelial cancer cell. There is less expression in normal tissue. So again, you want to get the cancer drug delivery to the cancer cells, right? But you want to minimize the toxicity to normal healthy tissue. And so you want a target that's minimally expressed in healthy normal tissue, but that's overexpressed in cancer tissue. And so that's why TROP2 is a particularly interesting target. We have seen a lot of data in heavily pretreated triple-negative breast cancer and hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. Again, as discussed previously, whenever we see those advantages, we typically move those strategies earlier on in the course of disease to see if we can further improve outcomes, progression-free survival, and ideally overall survival. So the ASCENT-03 study is a first-line study for patients with triple-negative breast cancer who don't qualify for immune therapy, so either they're PD-L1 negative or they've received prior PD-L1 targeting therapy, and they get randomized in the first-line setting to receive chemotherapy, which is our standard of care. And just as a reminder, the life expectancy of metastatic triple-negative breast cancer with conventional cytotoxic therapy is still only 12 to 18 months. Dismal, right? So we desperately need to do better in this space. So sacituzumab govitecan here, TROP2-directed antibody-drug conjugate going head-to-head against our gold standard, which is conventional chemotherapy. And you can see here a notable improvement in progression-free survival. And they did some landmark analyses at 6 and 12 months, showing that more than 10% improvement in progression-free survival at 6 months and a more robust improvement at 12 months. So this has totally changed the landscape for this disease. That being said, the overall survival is still unacceptable in this patient population. It's moved it towards 2 years instead of 12 to 18 months, but we still have a lot of work to do in this space. Another study that was presented at the same time as the ASCENT-03 is TROPION-Breast02. Same idea. It's taking patients with newly diagnosed triple-negative breast cancer and randomizing them to the standard of care, which is conventional chemotherapy, versus another TROP2-directed antibody-drug conjugate. Here it's Dato-DXd. Very similar design to the ASCENT-03 that I just showed you. Here they had co-primary endpoints of progression-free survival and overall survival, in part because with the prior trial that I just showed you, that was a standard of care in the second line and beyond, so patients could get access to it as second line and further therapy. So they allowed for crossover. Here, there was no access to Dato-DXd, so they could have this overall survival co-primary endpoint, but you see an essentially doubling in progression-free survival in the patient population with this approach. So still we're at about 24 months survival with this patient population. We have, in recent years, with the KEYNOTE-355 study, we have seen in the subset, which is about 30 to 40% of patients who have PD-L1 positive tumors, the benefit of adding immune therapy in the form of pembrolizumab to chemotherapy. So can we further improve on that experience? And again, even with the addition of immune therapy to chemotherapy in the first-line setting, this patient population, the median life expectancy is still only 2 years. We need to do better. So how might we do better? So it made sense, rational sense, that we would adopt some of the antibody-drug conjugates together with immune therapy, which is what we did in the ASCENT-04 study, going head-to-head against chemotherapy with immune therapy for patients who had PD-L1 positive tumors, using conventional definitions. And you can see a huge improvement in progression-free survival. Still only 11.2 months, right, with the addition of immune therapy to sacituzumab. So again, we still have more work to do, but certainly an improvement over the almost 8 months that we were historically seeing with just chemotherapy and immune therapy. So I don't know if you want to speak to the discussion questions, but how do you explain to a patient the similarities and differences in tolerability among the TROP2-directed antibody-drug conjugates for metastatic breast cancer? So we do have, in the PD-L1 negative, triple-negative breast cancer space, we do have two approved agents in that space, sacituzumab govitecan and datopotamab deruxtecan. They both are TROP2-directed antibody-drug conjugates. We can't compare the studies for the reason that I mentioned earlier, which is sacituzumab govitecan was already approved in heavily pretreated disease, so they incorporated a crossover that undermines the survival advantage that was seen with datopotamab deruxtecan. So you can't really compare those two options. I think it really comes down to toxicity. We heard about the eye toxicity. So datopotamab deruxtecan, you need to do eye drops from cycle one, day one, four times a day. You need to do the steroid mouthwash four times a day. It is debilitating when that mouth sore, they call it mucositis, but it's so sore when that occurs. So it really requires partnership with your patients. Sacituzumab govitecan is administered weeks one and two, every 3 week cycle. So I treat a lot of patients who travel for 4+ hours from West and East Texas. So coming in 2 weeks out of every 3 weeks isn't practical for them. So datopotamab deruxtecan, which is once every 3 weeks, might be a more palatable option for them that aligns with their quality of life. Sacituzumab govitecan, the primary issue with that drug is neutropenia. So within our system, we're able to give Neulasta with cycle one, day eight, and every cycle thereafter. A lot of institutions can't give Neulasta in the palliative setting. And so there are dose adjustments and other accommodations that can be incorporated if that's the preferred choice. So they really are becoming very nuanced conversations with our patients.
Well, let's move on to Jamie Carroll, who's going to take us through some of those kind of nuanced conversations around the GI and oral toxicities of these medications. So take it away, Jamie.
All right. So I'm going to be talking about the four different ADCs that are FDA approved for breast cancer. So I have them all listed here. As you can see, there's a variation in the GI side effects. For nausea, the range is 40% all the way up to 75%. I'm going to talk about the antiemetics that we recommend for our patients, but how I describe this to patients is, I can't promise I'm going to completely take away nausea, but I don't want you at home vomiting. So if you are at home vomiting, I need you to let me know, because maybe we can do something different about the antiemetics or how you're taking them. I want to make sure that in patient education that patients truly understand what meds are scheduled and what meds are PRN so that they're taking them the way that we want them to. And then I'm also going to talk through diarrhea and constipation and different strategies and patient education points that we have. So this slide here goes through the antiemetics that are recommended for each one of our antibody drug conjugates. The top two, olanzapine and dexamethasone, I want patients to take these as prescribed. One key pearl that I learned when I started prescribing olanzapine is that there is other FDA approvals for it. So you need to tell your patient that this is FDA approved as an antipsychotic, but that's not why I'm giving it to you. Because I had a patient call me and say, is there something you're not telling me? I'm like, no. I'm giving it to you for nausea. So it's just important that we tell patients that there's medications that have multiple different FDA approvals for. So olanzapine 5 milligrams for 5 nights at bedtime, and the dexamethasone 8 milligrams for 3 days. As you know, dexamethasone can cause insomnia, so if patients are able to take that earlier in the day. So we use that for multiple of our different ADCs, and then prochlorperazine and ondansetron, you can take those as needed. These are the antiemetics that are prescribed for the patient to take home. They also get medicines that are when they're in the chair during treatment. So this is not an exhaustive list. And then if nausea is persistent, you can add a Prepotent that's dosed day one, two, and three as a blister pack. So the first day they get a 125 milligram strength. I tell patients to bring that with them to treatment, but don't take it. It's a very expensive medicine. And so if I'm going to hold treatment for any reason, I want to make sure that they don't take the medicine prior to me saying, oh, now you need another blister pack. So they bring it with them to chemo, and then when I say, yep, we're going to treat today, then they can take it 30 to 60 minutes prior to their infusion. So some symptom-specific interventions for nausea and vomiting. I encourage them to take their scheduled antiemetics. Especially for cycle one, you can take around-the-clock dosing until you kind of understand what element of nausea you're going to have, because we can tell everybody, okay, this is the range of nausea, but I don't know how you're going to experience nausea until we give you the medicine. Small, frequent meals can help mitigate nausea, and then avoiding the trigger foods that are listed here. Oftentimes, patients want to know, is there anything that I can do that isn't a medicine? So acupuncture, acupressure can be very beneficial, and then ginger. Ginger chews, ginger ale, those things can also help mitigate nausea. And then for diarrhea, we recommend that they get loperamide. It's 2 milligram. I tell them to get tablets, not capsules. Tablets you can break in half. So if you have a patient that is really worried about constipation, then if they break the tablet in half, they're getting 1 milligram versus 2. There's many, many different ways that patients can take their loperamide. So really it's understanding how the patient, their past medical history, do they have any concerns for diarrhea / constipation? They can take their loperamide at their first stool and then subsequent stools. For patients that have known diarrhea concerns, you can take a loperamide in the morning when you get up, prior to any having any loose stools, and then you can take them subsequent stools. So max that I tell patients is 16 milligrams a day. So if you're taking 2 milligram tablets, you can have up to 8 in a day. Please let me know, though, if you're having greater than or equal to 4 stools in a day or overnight diarrhea. Nobody wants to be getting up in the middle of the night and having diarrhea. It's affecting their sleep. It's causing more fatigue. All of those things it compounds. So please, please let me know. Monitor for signs of dehydration. Obviously, if patients are having high volume stools or high frequency in stools, they're going to get dehydrated. So are they drinking enough at home? Do we need to add IV fluids to infusion? And then reviewing hydration strategies. I want patients to tell me number of ounces of water they're drinking a day, because if I ask them, are you drinking enough water, they're going to say yes. But enough water for that person versus if I think it's enough water, probably different. So I try to encourage everyone to tell me how many ounces or how many bottles of water they're drinking, so that we can truly be on the same page with, is it enough? If your patient is maximizing the antidiarrheals, they're still having high volume stools, then what do you do? We have to remember that these drugs do cause diarrhea, but so can bacterial bugs. So they can still get C. diff. They can still get E. coli. Other things that it doesn't matter how much loperamide they take, they're still going to have diarrhea because they have a bug that needs an antibiotic. So then you get a GI pathogen panel. It's a pretty comprehensive panel looking at all sorts of different things in their stool. If that is negative, then you could consider switching up their antidiarrheal to diphenoxylate with atropine to help dry up stool. And you can take that 4 times a day, max 8 tablets per day. And then constipation. So sometimes patients have alternating constipation and diarrhea. So then every day it can be a different strategy and how to mitigate side effects. But it's important to understand a good medication reconciliation. Are they on opioids? Are they on something that's causing more constipation than what you would anticipate? Consider their past medical history. Do they have a difference in their anatomy because they've had surgery that leads to constipation? What for this particular patient, truly understand your patient in front of you so that you can understand and help them in the best way. Encourage exercise to help move stool, hydration again. And then consider adding a bowel regimen. So they should be taking a daily stool softener plus osmotic a day. And then if that's not effective, let's add a stimulant, but keep up with your stool softener and your osmotic daily. And then red flag symptoms. So if patient's having greater than 4 bowel, has not had 4 bowel movements, has not had a bowel movement in 4 days, if they've got abdominal pain, vomiting, if they have hard stool with diarrhea, that's a challenging one because patients can get overflow diarrhea, so they're actually compacted and constipated, but then the stool is going, liquid stool is going around the compacted stool, and so patients think they've got diarrhea, and then they're taking loperamide to stop it when really they're constipated, so that's just a whole convoluted thing. Or if they're having rectal bleeding. So any of those are red flag symptoms. Stomatitis. So we talked a little bit about this, but it's the one of the most common side effects for datopotamab. It occurs in approximately 50% of patients, but prophylaxis is key. This stomatitis can develop around 14 days from starting dato. So it's really important that you start the dexamethasone mouth rinse. Patients are using it 4 times a day. And it's really important that they continue to do that because if median onset is 14 days and they say, well, I've been doing it for a week and I didn't get any mouth sores, so I stopped doing it. It's a pain. I have to do it 4 times a day. I have to take it to work. But if we can really encourage our patients to do it every day. If they don't have mouth sores, then you can back off in future cycles, but initially it's really important that we prevent mouth sores. Other options are magic mouthwash preparation, which is a combination of meds of diphenhydramine, lidocaine, and dexamethasone. Lidocaine viscous gel can be really helpful. You dab the gel on their actual mouth sore, and then patients can eat and drink. The key to that is don't swallow it because then you get lidocaine and you get numb more areas than just the mouth sores. And then just regular old baking soda and salt water rinses are very helpful.
Okay, thank you so much for that. We're going to try to catch up a little bit of time. And I think that I'm going to bip through this in 1 minute. But you guys have these slides because I want to make sure we get to Courtney's presentation on ILD. So I'm just going to take you through a little bit of what's coming, just so you can see the cool stuff that's coming in GYN cancers, where I think we've all said we need, all of our cancers, we need things desperately. So this is alphabet soup. This is raludotug deruxtecan. This is an antibody-drug conjugate that targets the protein cadherin 6. Thus far, we do not have to test for this protein, so this is in all comers. You can see the waterfall plot. And basically, every line that's going down means that patient's tumor shrunk, which is what you care about as a clinician. So basically, everyone on this trial had some, on this phase one, had some shrinkage of their tumor. And this drug has fast-track recognition, and it's currently in a registration-enabling phase 3 clinical trial that is open and accruing. This is the data from the phase 2. Again, just more patients, so you can see the waterfall plot. As a clinician, this is what I care about. This is what my patients care about. They want their tumors to get smaller, and they want to feel like normal human beings. And so we're hopeful that that will be accomplished with this medication. Just like T-DXd, the raludotug deruxtecan, trastuzumab deruxtecan, the side effects are similar. Common adverse events are GI. Rare things that we watch for are pneumonitis. We're going to talk about that next. Rinatabart sesutecan, another folate receptor alpha targeting antibody drug conjugate, distinct from mirvetuximab because this drug has a topoisomerase 1 payload. Mirvetuximab has a microtubule toxin. This is a DNA damaging agent. Similar but not the same as the deruxtecans. This also is in a phase 3 registration enabling study that completed accrual, and this will be the first readout for this class of drugs in ovarian cancer. So we're excited for that. And there's many coming. Like there's every drug company has a version of this. This is tavutotug, samrotecan. This is targeting folate as well. You can see the waterfall plots. This is just going to be the theme. These drugs look good. They work. TROP2 we've looked at as well. I'm not going to take you through the waterfall plots, but we've seen nice efficacy in a platinum-resistant setting, just as you've heard in other disease types. And so right now we have more targets than I can take you through. They all look about the same in small phase 1 studies with 50-ish to 100-ish patients, response rates in the 50% range, clinical benefit rate in the 70 to 80% range. It's going to come down to safety, schedule, and sequencing in terms of how we use these effective medications for our patients. But
what we need to think about is the side effects and making sure that we recognize them early so that we don't have unintended severe or lethal side effects, one of which is ILD pneumonitis. And so I'm going to turn it over to Courtney to take us through this.
I'm going to get through this really quickly and get you guys out on time, but this is a really important topic. So we're going to talk about ILD and pneumonitis with use of ADCs. The risk of pneumonitis varies depending on which ADC you're using. The percentage of the risk changes, and also the severity of the pneumonitis can change. So make sure you're aware of which ADC you're giving and the risk factors for pneumonitis. Regardless, make sure you're counseling your patient on the risk of ILD pneumonitis. Each patient can also have risk factors that can increase their risk of developing pneumonitis. Those include environmental or occupational factors. Or if a patient has an autoimmune or an inflammatory disease, those patients might have a higher risk of developing pneumonitis. Or prior lung disease like COPD, asthma, ILD, smoking. So if you have a patient who's a smoker, they could be at increased risk of pneumonitis, prior radiation, and then also other medications. So not only chemotherapy or immunotherapy can increase the risk of pneumonitis, but some antibiotics, antiarrhythmics, immune-suppressing agents. So prior to starting your patient on an ADC, make sure you're looking at the patient, see if they're higher risk of developing pneumonitis. And for those patients that are a higher risk, you might want to get more frequent imaging. Treat all the patients the same as far as counseling them on the risk of pneumonitis, but be aware if you have a patient who has more risk factors. As far as diagnosis goes, clinical assessment is really important. Getting a good history. Every single patient that walks in for clinic who's on an ADC, make sure you're asking them if they're having any respiratory symptoms indicative of pneumonitis. That's most commonly cough, shortness of breath, chest pain. It does not have to be a patient calling because they can't catch their breath or they're having significant shortness of breath. It can be subtle. It can be a patient normally is able to go up and down the stairs to do laundry, and now they've noticed that they can't carry the basket full of clothes because they get short of breath too easily. It doesn't have to be significant symptoms to be pneumonitis. Physical examination is also really important. Listen to their lungs, look at their vital signs, specifically their oxygen. I've had patients come in who have zero symptoms concerning for pneumonitis, but their baseline oxygen is 98, 99%. That day it's 91%. Get imaging of their chest and they have pneumonitis. Get a good history, do a good physical exam on all these patients who are being treated with ADCs. If there's suspicion for ILD, you want to get imaging of their chest, preferably high-resolution CT chest, but get imaging of their chest. That's the best way to diagnose pneumonitis. I think we're all quick to, if someone's on an ADC and they have respiratory symptoms, we automatically kind of assume it's pneumonitis, but you also want to rule out other causes such as infection. Sometimes you need to consult pulmonary or even get a bronchoscopy to help with the diagnosis. Some things that can help distinguish whether it's drug-induced ILD versus, you know, infection or something else is timing of their symptoms. The pattern on their imaging can look different, whether it's an infectious process versus pneumonitis, and then their response to treatment. Management very much depends on the severity of the pneumonitis, both based on their symptoms as well as imaging, and again, the ADC that you're using. In general, though, if there's any suspicion for pneumonitis, you want to hold ADC therapy. Depending on the severity, you might need to prescribe corticosteroids. You also want to manage their symptoms. We're quick to just give steroids for these patients who have pneumonitis, but look at your patient. Do they need oxygen supplementation? Do they need an inhaler? Do they need referred to pulmonary? Some of these patients can have long-term effects from the fibrosis, so not just treating with steroids, but also make sure you're managing the symptoms. Getting the imaging to show pneumonitis is important, but also repeating imaging to make sure that their pneumonitis has resolved, and then doing serial imaging to make sure that it's not recurring. Some patients do require hospitalization. Criteria for hospitalization would be new oxygen requirement, progressive symptoms despite supportive care, or if there's significant involvement on imaging. We've had patients where their symptoms aren't that bad, their vitals are stable, but you look at their CT scan and you're like, this is impressive. And so we send those patients in. We observe them. We get pulmonary on board. Sometimes they need IV steroids. So just look at the patient and, you know, depending on the severity of their symptoms and imaging, and treat them. I think I skipped one. Some key takeaways. Patient education. Make sure they're aware of when to call. Early detection. Quick intervention. Utilizing a multidisciplinary approach with pulmonology to make sure you're best treating the patient, but really education, make sure they're aware of symptoms to be looking for and reasons to call. I'm going to do a very quick case study. This is a 54-year-old with recurrent high-grade or endometrial cancer. She was initially diagnosed with stage 3. Something significant about her history is both of her children actually passed away unexpectedly, so she was raising one of her grandchildren. And so she's one of those patients that you automatically worry she's not taking care of herself, her focus is on taking care of her family, and she sometimes minimizes symptoms. She also had a medical history notable for diabetes. When she was initially diagnosed, she received 6 cycles of paclitaxel, carboplatin, and she also received pelvic radiation. A little less than 6 months later, she had a CT scan that showed a new liver lesion that was biopsy-confirmed disease recurrence, and at that time, she was treated with lenvatinib and pembrolizumab and was found to have disease progression. She was then treated with T-DXd. She came in, essentially, she had imaging after 6 cycles that showed significant improvement in her disease, no evidence of pneumonitis. 2 weeks later, she called with a dry cough, and she actually didn't call. She went to her primary care doctor to manage her diabetes, who called us and said that she had this significant cough and wanted to make sure it was okay to prescribe test Lumpurls. Because of that, we ordered another CT of chest. It showed significant pneumonitis. She ended up being hospitalized, getting IV steroids. Another thing is when she had the cough, we sent home a pulse ox with her. Her oxygen that day was 95%. The next day, it dropped to 79%. So a few really big learning points for this. Number one, she just had CT scans 2 weeks ago that showed no evidence of pneumonitis, developed a cough. We repeated imaging, and it was significant. Repeat the imaging if your patient develops symptoms. Number two, give them pulse ox. If you have a patient high risk of developing pneumonitis, or if you're worried about them reporting symptoms, have them monitor their oxygen levels at home. And then keeping in mind, some of these patients have diabetes, giving them high-dose steroids. Sometimes we have to get endocrinology involved to help with, like, sliding scale insulin, things like that.
Great. Thank you so much for that. We're going to end today with Module 7. I'm going to turn it over to Eddie Guerin again to bring us home with lung cancer. Take it away.
Yeah, thank you. And I may go a little bit quickly because I know we're a little behind on time and in case we want questions. So we can skip the patient case that we have and just move on to IDXD. So this is an antibody drug conjugate against B7H3. And this is one of the areas of significant development in lung cancer in general and antibody drug conjugates, which is small cell lung cancer. Although B7H3 is a target in non-small cell lung cancer as well as other malignancies, really the development has largely been in small cell lung cancer. Here we can see the waterfall plot that shows, particularly at the 12 milligram per kilogram, over 50% of patients are experiencing a radiographic evidence of response. We can skip this slide to save on time. But basically, here you can see the safety data, and as might be anticipated, there are more toxicities at the higher 12 milligram per kilogram dose as compared to the 8 milligram per kilogram dose. This is sometimes described as a tornado plot and sort of looks for like a tornado based on size. But here they're just looking and comparing the two different doses. You see that these tend to be sort of chemotherapy toxicities, as might be expected. This again, the payload here is again deruxtecan. It is just a different antibody. This study, this agent is being evaluated in multiple other studies, including a randomized study versus current standard of care. And lastly, I'm not going to dwell too much on this specific study. This happens to be EVOKE-02, which is looking at substituting, in this case, sacituzumab govotecan for one or both of the chemotherapeutic agents that would be used along with immunotherapy. And I would say that this, in many respects, exemplifies much of the other development that we are seeing currently in lung cancer, where people are trying to add antibody drug conjugates to drugs that are already approved in other settings, and immunotherapy, as one might imagine, ends up being one of the particularly common areas where this is seen. Here you can see the safety data for this particular study, and I'm not going to belabor it, but obviously one of the things that's always going to be evaluated is, do you sort of end up amplifying the immunotherapy toxicities? We haven't really seen that. We do have a press release that says at least for the progression-free survival that this is a positive study, but we will see what that means overall from the perspective of drug development when we formally see the data.
All right. That was, I know, rapid fire to get through.
I know when we're short on time.
We are really short on time. And you'll have all of our slides. People always reach out to us after. But we get through a lot of content in 90 minutes. So I just want to thank the panel for really putting the effort in to put these slides together and hopefully provide some meaningful education for you on antibody-drug conjugates. And with that, please thank my panel and thank you for attending, everybody.